We are exploring a Marquette University professor's research into the mental health needs of pregnant people fleeing violence in South America and how it informs support systems for refugees and marginalized communities here, closer to home. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be along with us. Marquette University professor Lisa Edwards directs the Culture and Well-Being Research Lab in the Department of Counselor Education and Counseling Psychology. She landed a prestigious Fulbright, taking her to Medellin, Colombia this year to study pregnant and postpartum refugees fleeing neighboring Venezuela. What do you want to know about the effects of war and violence on a pregnancy? Thousands of migrants cross the U.S. border each day. What actions should the U.S. take confronting pregnant or postpartum refugees? What have you learned about environmental trauma and pregnancy? 800-642-1234 to join in. Lisa Edwards, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Good morning. Why is it important to study people going through horrible trauma, horrible environmental stressors in pregnancy and postpartum?
Well, that's a great question. We have a growing body of evidence, and we're learning more every day about the importance of the mental health of mothers when they're pregnant and postpartum during what we call the perinatal period. The effects of stress on moms are really profound. There's research showing us that there are short-term outcomes. For example, moms who are really stressed when their baby's in utero might have low birth weight babies or preterm labor complications during pregnancy. And then we see those outcomes once the baby is born in the form of decreased attachment with mother, which is really a concern for developmental outcomes. Later, when kids are 5, 6, and 7, there's a lack of prosocial behavior, and there may be other cognitive, behavioral, emotional concerns. So we know that that time period is really critical and that we need to minimize the stress that moms are experiencing as much as possible.
So what I'm hearing from you is that the perinatal period is that really sensitive time, weeks before and after birth, and it, you know, these conditions and stressors can really snowball in a baby's life.
Absolutely. What's interesting to think about is that, pregnancy is a very important period, obviously, and a delicate period. And there's even periods within pregnancy that have more and less impact on development. And we're still trying to figure that out. But mental health concerns are very common during pregnancy. In fact, globally, 1 in 5 women will experience mental health concerns when they're pregnant or postpartum, usually in the form of depression and anxiety. So it is, in fact, the most common complication of the pregnancy and postpartum period. Yet if they're untreated and if they are incredible stresses like trauma and conflict and things like that, then they can really develop into concerning issues that have long-term impacts on mom, the baby, and in fact, science is showing us for generations to come because it really affects the way that even genes can be expressed over time. So it really is profound, the potential for both positive development and negative.
Talking with Lisa Edwards, who is director of the Culture and Well-Being Research Lab at Marquette University, who is in Colombia studying how fleeing violence impacts mothers during the perinatal period. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have at the intersection of trauma and pregnancy? What resources helped you get through the early stages? Join in, 800-642-1234. Lisa, let's talk about the people who you will be studying. We're reaching you, obviously, in Colombia. What are the lives like as these people uproot from Venezuela and come in to Colombia?
Great question. And we're about to embark upon our project, but we've actually started developing our protocol. And I'm working with colleagues in nursing and psychology at Universidad CES, which is a university here in Medellin. And but what we know about Venezuelan mothers who are coming, and you know, there have been Venezuelan refugees, or the common term used here is migrants, who have been coming to Colombia over the past 5, 7, 9 years when they've been experiencing what many are calling a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. Incredible financial instability, lack of access to care, especially health care, crime,
and
different things.
I might add that they live under the authoritarian rule of the government.
Absolutely.
Of Nicolas Maduro.
Absolutely. And that all contributes to that humanitarian crisis. And so, but when we look at pregnant and postpartum mothers and mothers in general who are coming to Colombia, they often have not had the opportunity to have any kind of prenatal care. And so that's a huge part of this equation is they're arriving to Colombia. Fortunately, they receive Colombia is very receptive to these migrants, and so they will receive access to healthcare resources where they can attend to themselves and to their unborn baby and other children that they might have. They can begin to get basic needs met, such as food and nutrition for their babies. And then our project, we're very excited. We're going to be talking to them about their mental health because that's the piece that's often ignored when we talk about the development of the baby. We're always thinking, is baby healthy? Is mom okay? But we're not talking about the emotional and psychological part of this. So that's what we'll be doing while we're here.
So how does the government in Venezuela intersect with their health care, with their pregnancy, and what support systems are in place by the government, or perhaps non-existent programs? Like, what care is coming from the government of Venezuela for these people?
Well, what we're most attuned to here is really how when they arrive here, and
okay.
we find that they have that they maybe haven't even had any prenatal visits, as I mentioned before. Mm. So that's what we're really seeing as moms who haven't been able to ever, hear the baby's heartbeat or get any checkups like we might hear within the U.S. And so that's where we're really seeing some of the concerns, and we want to get them in as soon as possible.
There's so much testing and monitoring in pregnancy, and I would imagine if you haven't had any of those prenatal visits, that too, from a Western medicine standpoint, can be very dangerous.
Absolutely. And then just thinking about something basic like nutrition. Mm. I mean, malnutrition is something that happens in times of crisis and times of war. And the effects of that on the developing fetus can be profound as well. And we've known that for quite some time. So all of this comes together to say that moms who are coming here to Colombia need much support emotionally and physically.
A parallel we might be thinking about as the U.S. accepts up to 100,000 Ukrainian refugees and thinking about mm-hmm. war-torn Ukraine pregnant mothers in this time period. What might your research draw from on how the U.S. would prevent further traumatizing for expectant people who are coming from a war-ravaged region?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think our research and really some of the research that we have globally suggests that, first, it's clear moms are incredibly resilient and determined. And we see these images of moms crossing borders, fleeing violence. Their goal to maintain the safety of their baby and to give them opportunities it's truly inspiring. And these moms, we need to make sure that they receive all the physical health care that they need, that they, that we can help them navigate things like legal status and access to resources. Then this other piece that our research is really interested in is that psychological component. If we as a world supported moms, immigrant moms, all moms, we truly could be impacting their mental health for generations to come.
Hmm. Marquette University's Lisa Edwards, professor of counseling psychology, counselor education. Anna Fulbright, we're reaching her in Colombia. She studies the challenges of pregnant people fleeing Venezuela. What resources helped you get through the early days after delivery? Have you worried about pregnancy care and delivering in Ukraine? And as Afghan refugees resettle in Wisconsin, do you have a story to share about supporting a new parent and their baby? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lisa Edwards here in the Ideas Network. We're looking at resiliency in pregnancy and how pregnant refugees and those who have just had a baby, how exposure to trauma affects this delicate time in life. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're with Marquette University Professor Lisa Edwards, Anna Fulbright, that's taken her to Colombia to study this. Lisa leads the Milwaukee-based program Proyecto Mama, which assesses the resources and mental health needs of Latinx people in the perinatal period. What is on your mind about trauma and pregnant refugees? Are you worried about deportation and family separations that could add additional trauma? Clinicians, how do you provide support to patients who are expecting and going through trauma? Join in 800-642-1234. Marquette's Lisa Edwards with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's turn to your multi-year project, Proyecto Mama, and what you're seeing there with barriers to mental health resources that you found through this program.
Absolutely. So Proyecto Mama, our intention with developing this project was to really get a sense of the landscape in Milwaukee in particular. What were resources that moms could access, and where were there some holes in resources? And through this project, we assembled a task force of various community members and health professionals with both expertise in the topic and a passion for it. And then we did a lot of interviews. We spoke with moms, we spoke with health professionals, counselors, nurses, midwives. And then we also spoke with faith leaders in the community. And we took all this stakeholder information and tried to find some of the common themes. And importantly, it's very critical to realize that we have incredible Latinx serving agencies here in Milwaukee. We are so fortunate. So many that offer bilingual services and that offer culturally responsive services. So this is a really good thing that we found, and many of the moms access these services. But like every city and state within the nation, we can do more. I mean, these agencies are stretched thin, and we are always in need of more bilingual counselors and therapists and folks who can have maybe a little more expertise in the perinatal health, mental health period. So we found that there, more services, affordable services with childcare options and flexible options for support groups and things like that are some of the things that we'd love to see even more of in our city.
And I would imagine, you know, in Milwaukee, that is one city in Wisconsin, the largest city, of course, and perhaps these services are there. But when you look at the rest of Wisconsin, you might not see that same picture.
Absolutely. Yes, I think we can safely say that Milwaukee has the largest amount of services. I mean, there are some in other cities. And of course, with the growing Latinx population, those are growing as well. But Milwaukee has some that have been here for quite some time also.
I'm thinking about these interviews and then the interviews that you will be embarking on with these people coming from Venezuela. And I'm wondering if you're going to see intersections there between what you saw in Milwaukee and heard from stakeholders in Milwaukee versus what is happening in South America.
Yes, that remains to be seen. I have some thoughts about that, and we're really excited to see what these findings will be. I have a feeling, I mean, one of the biggest barriers to service, in addition to the practical things like insurance and the cost of counseling and childcare, but one of the big things that we found was there's so much stigma around getting mental health treatment and support. And I believe that is something that we face globally. Here in the U.S., we're starting to see a lot more attention to the importance of mental health. But when you think about the perinatal period in particular, the narrative is that as a mother, you're supposed to be so joyful and so happy. And how on earth could you be having concerns or anxiety or feeling down or, you know, even worse, having scary thoughts about your baby and fears that you might harm it. These are things that for so long have been absolutely taboo. And we found in our moms, most of whom were of Mexican descent and some Central American descent, that was really prominent for them. And that's true, as I said, in the general population. And I have a feeling that will be very true for some of these Venezuelan moms at all as well. And in addition to the stigma, sometimes we feel as moms that we don't, perhaps we just need to focus on the physical, and the emotional comes later. Hmm. And maybe we don't even have the privilege to give that the attention. And so I would venture we might see some of that as these Venezuelan migrant mothers are really just seeking safety and getting the basic needs that they want and deserve.
Thinking about postpartum depression and how it is stigmatized here in the U.S. for well-resourced people who have had a baby. And I would imagine that you see that too in all aspects of the people you interview, that stigma perhaps is there as well with postpartum depression.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, here in the U.S., we have some important public health campaigns around that, but it's absolutely stigmatized. And, you know, there's some interesting layers. Cultural context is everything. When we would interview moms in Milwaukee, particularly those who don't have citizenship, who are undocumented, you know, there is not only this fear of perhaps saying that you're not feeling well and your child could be removed by CPS if they deem you unfit. And you know, that has happened to moms of all backgrounds. But then there's this extra fear of talking about your mental health concerns and then potentially being detained or deported. And so these are all legitimate reasons why moms might not come forward and talk about their concerns and seek help. And these are barriers we really need to address.
Talking with Lisa Edwards of Marquette University, Professor Leeds Proyecto Mama, reaching her in Colombia on a Fulbright. Lisa, I'm wondering how these surveys that you've done, these many interviews you've done, how it's informing how you go about teaching counseling psychology to students.
Oh, that's a great question. I think, you know, everything we do as researchers informs our teaching and vice versa. Mm. To me, I focus a lot on multicultural counseling and Latinx psychology. And so all of this is really just enriching it and reminding me so often of the importance of context. And we try to make some sort of generalizations in our field. And at the same time, we have to balance that with understanding the individual and the unique circumstances and things like intersectionality. People are not just women. They're not just Venezuelans. They're not just migrants. It's all together at once. So I think that really just continuously helps me to remember that.
Looking at some other takeaways, Badger Care Plus, the state and federal Medicaid program providing health coverage for low-income Wisconsin residents. Right now, it only lasts for the first month after, you know, after birth. How could extending Badger Care lessen the burden for people who have delivered a baby?
Yes. Just to clarify, the Badger Care Plus prenatal plan is something that people without documentation here in the U.S. are eligible for. And so it does end at the month after when pregnancy ends. And this happens in other states as well, but there is definitely a huge move to or desire to be able to extend that, because after mom has her baby, it could take a few weeks before the mental health concerns come up. And if this mom doesn't have access to any kinds of services because of insurance, then she's absolutely stuck without that support that we know is so critical.
As we start to wrap up here, what is your advice to clinicians who are seeing patients who are experiencing trauma that they might have never gone through themselves, or they might not even know how horrible it really is?
Well, there's a lot I would suggest. I think it's important for all of us. I'm a psychologist as well, to be informed regarding perinatal mental health. Not everyone is going to go for the deep dive and the advanced training, but it's important to be aware of the issues. First and foremost, and this really is popular in our field, is understanding culturally responsive treatment and understanding who it is that we're working with and trying to understand our own biases and privileges and cultural context in order to be as culturally responsive as possible. So I think clinicians really need to be attuned to that and also get a sense for those who are in Milwaukee in particular and Wisconsin and you know, to get a sense of what the, where the networks are, because there is some amazing work being done in a lot of different areas here.
Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Edwards directs the Culture and Wellbeing Research Lab at Marquette University. Leads Proyecto Mama reached her in Colombia on a Fulbright studying pregnant people fleeing violence. Find a link to Proyecto Mama at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we have the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the spring election day, we're in conversation with the head of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan Wolf is here. But first, it's a look at school board elections today that will shape local education policy for the next several years. The results will have the most impact on a group of people who mostly don't have a say at the ballot box. That is students. But as Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin students are finding other ways to make their voices heard.
Allie Schlicht is a junior at La Crosse Central High School, where she's on the debate team. She's also part of a group of students in La Crosse who are working to connect the candidates in the local school board race to the students they'd be making decisions for.
That's probably always a concern of students, is a lot of times they just don't feel heard by adults. So that is something that we are, or I am looking for in a school board candidate, is somebody who would listen to students.
Allie and other students with the youth advocacy group Leaders Igniting Transformation organized forums for the school board candidates, where they asked about some of the issues they most want to see addressed.
According to the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction data from the 2018...
At a forum in March, Kaylin Adams noted that Black students are disproportionately likely to be suspended in La Crosse schools.
As a school board member, how would you go about reducing racial disparities and school discipline?
Kaylin got involved with lobbying the school board after going to racial justice protests in the summer of 2020 sparked her interest in political action.
The most only thing we could really do is just say what we need to say and then hope that it gets taken into consideration.
With the voting age at 18 and up, typically only seniors, and not even all of them, can vote for school board members. Allie says a board that answers more to students would probably look a little different.
I think a lot of the candidates would be focusing their campaign more on reaching those students and really seeing what they wanted more. Most likely also would be focusing their campaign strategies towards addressing the problems that students feel the most concerned about.
For the La Crosse students, one of those problems is mental health. They even successfully lobbied their board to put $100,000 of the school's federal relief funds toward mental health services. They also say addressing racial disparities and reducing the district's carbon footprint should be priorities. Some Wisconsin school boards have given students a literal seat at the table, if not a vote. Menominee Falls, Sun Prairie, Howard Suamico, and other districts have 2 non-voting student seats on their board. Bayport junior Kara Reen joined the Howard Suamico board in spring 2021, a contentious time when the state mask mandate had just been overturned and school boards were scrambling for next steps.
It was just a very, very fiery school meeting for around since I joined. So being part of that, I think, just gives me more awareness about what's going on in my community.
She says all the uproar can be frustrating. Kara would like to see the board be able to focus on issues the student body cares about, like support and funding for social-emotional learning or equity in educational access, especially in areas like math and technology.
Really, this is about students from elementary to high school and being ready for the future. As a student, I just don't want the board to constantly have petty fights over things that really aren't about students or school board issues.
Rohan Gala is a Bayport senior and the other student board member. He says national arguments over race and library books and LGBTQ issues have been overtaking board meetings in Wisconsin. That's created what he calls a heightened tension around school board meetings.
Parents and the community members now see the importance of school board meetings and the things that school boards talk about. And so While I would like to see a lessening of tensions within the school board, I also don't think that that could happen.
In the meantime, Kara, Allie, and Kaylin say they've seen more of their fellow students interested in this year's school board elections than ever before. The students say they may not stay engaged with these school boards forever, especially if they move away for college or work. But it has made them passionate about political engagement and how they can make their voices heard. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now to Wisconsin's top elections administrator, Megan Wolf of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, here on this spring election day when polls are open. Some roadmap for our conversation. We'll look at the litigation around absentee voting and the use of drop boxes, the training of municipal clerks, and what changes her bipartisan regulatory agency is making since the Legislative Audit Bureau released its report in October scrutinizing the 2020 presidential election. Are you voting today? Share your experience, what it's like, what you see out there. Do you feel elections are secure? 800-642-1234. Administrator Megan Wolf, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning and happy election day.
Happy election day to you. And in those words, can you take us inside the Wisconsin Elections Commission, share with us some things that go on the inside on a day like this, what you could encounter?
Sure. So today, you know, election officials at the state level, we're really working on just answering phone calls, answering questions and emails that come in from our local election officials, from voters as they're navigating the election process. So that's really what we focus on. We have extended hours on an election day to make sure that, you know, those early morning questions and those late night questions as the clerks are finishing the counting of the ballots, that we're available to answer those. But I expect that today will be a relatively smooth election. You know, our April election is going to be those local contests that are happening in all of your local communities. It's our nonpartisan spring election. And so we'll keep monitoring the day and see what issues might pop up. But our job is really just to support our local election officials and our voters as they navigate today.
I want to pick up on answering the phones because there are more than 1,800 municipal election clerks in our state, and I'd imagine they'll encounter something today that may need your guidance on, whether it's legal or technology, like a paper jam or logistical, I don't know. You know, how do you interact with clerks on election day and triage what's coming at you?
Well, Election Day, I think, is just, it's such a great day for so many reasons. But, you know, we're a small staff at the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So we have just about 40 staff in our office. And like you said, there are 1,850 cities, towns, and villages. There are also 72 county clerks that are busy supporting today's election as well. And then, of course, we've got, you know, about 4.2 million eligible voters here in the state of Wisconsin. So there's never a dull moment. I don't think we put down the phone almost all election day as we're answering those questions, but it's a really exciting day. And like you said, we get a chance to answer questions. I've been in elections for 11 years, and there are still new questions that come in every day that we have to work through with our legal departments and with a lot of our election experts in our office to help the clerks figure out.
What might be those fresh new questions that come in? Can you give an example?
Oh boy. Well, the polls have only been open for 42 minutes, so we haven't seen any real unique questions yet. But we have seen some questions already looking ahead to end of night procedures, sort of, you know, where does a voter return their ballot if they received an absentee ballot, those types of questions. And, you know, just a couple of reminders for voters, because we certainly get voter questions too on election day. All polls in the state of Wisconsin open at 7:00 a.m. and they all close at 8 p.m. tonight. So as long as you're in line by 8 p.m., you'll be able to vote. And you should make sure that you're checking our website, which is myvote.wi.gov. And that will show you where your polling place is. It will also show you a sample ballot Some polling places may have changed, especially since the last general election. So please do check that out before you head to the polls today.
And that is due to redistricting, where voters may see changes to their voting locations. And I'm wondering, can you quantify in any way or describe the volume of changes you're seeing to polling place locations?
Yeah, so some of it is due to redistricting. So local redistricting still happened, you know, despite some of the challenges that are still ongoing with some of the state level lines. So yes, there are some changes that are due to local redistricting, but there's also changes that happen anytime you have a smaller election versus a larger general election. Sometimes the clerks have to find a new space, make sure that that space is ADA compliant. There are all sorts of considerations that go into choosing a polling place and choosing a polling place that's right for that election and ensuring they have enough poll workers and that it's in a location that makes the most sense for their voters. So polling places can change for any election. So I always encourage people to take a look before they head to the polls for any election to make sure your polling place hasn't changed.
Let's talk absentee voting. The commission is recommending voters should check with their local clerks, as you mentioned, about the rules for returning absentee ballots. And, you know, after the back and forth in the courts, we now know that unmonitored ballot drop boxes were ultimately banned for use in the spring election. What is your guidance to municipal clerks about drop boxes?
So right now, we are still waiting on a court decision, so there isn't any guidance. We're actually not allowed per that court decision to issue any additional guidance on that. So it really is up to the local officials to make sure that they're abiding by that court order. But what does that mean for a voter practically?
Yes.
So practically speaking, today, if you still have an absentee ballot that was sent to you, so you requested your absentee ballot, and you want to return that, the first thing you should do is take a look at the instructions that came with your absentee ballot. It's going to tell you where to return it on election day. And what I mean by that is, should you bring it to your clerk's office? Does your jurisdiction have a central count facility where they count all the absentee ballots? Or should you bring it to your polling place? So if you do have an absentee ballot that you have not returned yet, you can return that. Now, you can't open it and feed that ballot through the voting equipment, but you can return that to your municipal clerk by 8 p.m.
How are
you? If you have an absentee, please go ahead.
How are your municipal clerks responding to voters with disabilities that prevent them from personally getting to the polls or personally getting their ballot to municipal clerks?
I would encourage those voters to reach out to their municipal clerk if they have questions or concerns about how they're going to return their ballot today. And also, hopefully, we'll have some additional clarity through the ongoing litigation, the consideration of the Wisconsin Supreme Court for the elections later this fall.
Let's turn to the audit. After the 2020 election, the Legislative Audit Bureau completed a review, issued 30 recommendations to the Wisconsin Elections Commission. What is the status of implementing these changes?
So on Friday, we sent a report to the Legislative Committee that oversees audits, and we were very pleased to report that the commission, and the commission is the 6-member bipartisan commission, has considered all 30 recommendations and has made tremendous progress in implementing those. Some of those things are things that we were able to implement very quickly. Others were taking a look at administrative rules that perhaps have been submitted earlier, some of them as early as 2017, and were expired through the process where they're approved by the governor's office. And so we were able to resubmit some of those. We've even held some public hearings on administrative rules. So the commission is really making tremendous progress. And I think that it's really a testament to the commission that they're able to work together in such a bipartisan way, because any decision of the commission requires 4 votes. It requires a bipartisan vote to look at and to implement some really good policy as it relates to those recommendations.
In your mind, what are the key recommendations? What are the key policy things that you think should really get through?
So there were some changes, for example, that I think just help us to have additional checks on the system. So, for example, one of the things that we called out in the report is that we were able to add some additional matching criteria that every night we can run when we check for duplicate voter records, that we can add some additional criteria to make sure that we always catch those duplicate registration records. When I say duplicates, I mean, let's say you moved and you now have a new registration at your new address. We need to make sure that that new registration gets merged with your old registration. And so they gave us some ideas about additional criteria to add to that process. That was something we were able to implement right away. And then, of course, administrative rules, which, you know, I'm sure a lot of people don't, you know, have a lot of experience with administrative rules. It's a very complex process. But the commission has been working very diligently to address all of those. It's about an 18-month process. Mm. And so they've been working through that process with some of those recommendations at each of their meetings.
Wisconsin Elections Commission top administrator Megan Wolf stays with us on the spring election day as the polls opened this hour, close at 8 tonight, taking your questions about election process, voting integrity, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're back with the administrator of the six-member nonpartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission, Megan Wolf, here on the spring election day as we dig into election security, integrity on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you think could improve the electoral process? How do you feel about the use of ballot drop boxes in the past? What's your take on the findings to date in the GOP-backed Gableman investigation into the 2020 presidential election? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Administrator Megan Wolf with us for about six more minutes. Let's talk about the Gableman investigation. Nearly a month since the interim report came out, Michael Gableman issued this report on the 2020 elections, urging lawmakers to eliminate and dismantle the Elections Commission. He said you should be fired. And the commission said his interim report contained misunderstandings, false information. What do you think Gableman is getting wrong?
So we did put out a statement after the report, and we did point out the fact that there are a number of places where the report does overlap with the Legislative Audit Bureau's recommendations. So, of course, those have been considered and are being implemented by the commission. But I really think that, you know, in elections, any review of an election, and there certainly are processes in statute that constitute as a review. So we have canvass, we have recounts, we even have audits of the post-election of the voting equipment. And all of those things were conducted in 2020, and all of them showed that the results of the election were accurate and that they were secure. And so we're going to continue to focus our efforts on continuing to implement and deliver fair and secure elections to Wisconsin.
Just want to make a finer point there. Have you made any changes to the elections process or how your commission operates based on his interim report findings?
The commission has not considered that beyond the, again, the recommendations that do overlap with the Legislative Audit Bureau's report.
Voting in Wisconsin nursing homes has itself become a battleground in these times. Gableman said there was voting fraud in nursing homes, and election observers say he's sowing mistrust and it doesn't rise to election fraud. How are people casting a ballot in the spring election who live in long-term care facilities?
Yeah, so there's special voting deputies is a process where clerks appoint two bipartisan special voting deputies to visit care facilities and to conduct voting with the residents. What the law says that is that the SVDs have to attempt to make two visits with those residents. And if they're unable to meet with residents that would like to vote, then the clerk has to proceed to mailing ballots to those residents. And so those provisions are fully in place. In 2020, the visits to the care facilities were impossible. The clerks were not able to make those visits to the care facilities. And so they had to proceed to the mailing part of the statute. But right now, the health conditions have improved and special voting deputies are able to visit those eligible care facilities.
Megan Wolf, administrator for the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Let's go to the phones. Jimmy is with us from Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Morning. Yeah, I've heard the latest wrinkle on this election conspiracy thing is some folks want to have just paper ballots that could be tallied by hand, no machines. What would that do to the Wisconsin election? How do you see that working?
Jimmy, thanks.
Thanks for your question. So Wisconsin state statute actually requires most jurisdictions to utilize voting equipment. So it's a requirement in the statute that any of our medium to large size jurisdictions, they have to use that voting equipment to tabulate the ballots. And my guess is, you know, I don't speculate on legislative intent, but, you know, humans make more errors than machines typically, especially after a very long election day. And so any changes to that process would require a law change. So it would need to be changed by law by the legislature and, of course, signed by the governor before jurisdictions would be able to go to hand count. Now, we do have some really small jurisdictions that under law are able to utilize hand count paper ballots. So that's going to happen in some of those really small townships. Mm. But even in those communities, the law still requires that they have some type of electronic voting equipment available for voters with disabilities to assist them with marking their ballot.
Let's go to Warren now in Oconto County. Warren, you've been out there. What did you experience in voting this morning?
Good morning. Yes, I was at the polling place just a little bit ago and noticed that my ballot had not been initialed by two clerks. I brought it to the attention of the workers there. One of the supervisors had the initials put onto my ballot. I put it through the machine, and I was voter number 15, so the 14 people who voted before me, I don't know if their votes are going to count. And in a pretty small jurisdiction, especially on these nonpartisan races, there's not a whole lot of voter turnout anyway. So what's going to happen with those 14 votes that were cast before mine was cast?
Great question. And, you know, you touch on something, which is that absentee ballots are essentially sort of adjudicated, and it's decided which ones are going to count by your local board of absentee canvassers. And that is a publicly observable process. So when there are situations like that, where a procedure perhaps was not followed, like initialing the ballot, that absentee board of canvassers is going to look at those ballots and determine whether or not they should be counted. Now, typically, the law errs on the side of the voter in terms of if the election official has made a mistake that would impact the voter, that ballot is still going to count unless they have other reasons to challenge the ballot or the eligibility of the elector. But those decisions are going to be made by your local board of canvass, and that is something that voters can observe if they have questions or concerns.
Administrator Megan Wolf, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan Wolf is administrator for the Wisconsin Elections Commission. We have a link to the My Vote WI portal for all voting and election information from the WEC. That link is at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, it's transit managers in smaller communities about the challenges of funding public transit outside of large cities. Do you live in a rural area? What transit projects hold the most promise? It's 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're with us on the Ideas Network.